I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Narges Mohammadi is a woman, a human rights advocate, and a freedom fighter.
One of Iran's most prominent human rights activists, Narges Mohammadi, has won this year's Nobel Peace Prize, but she will not be able to receive the prize in Oslo personally since she's in prison in Tehran. We'll get the response. We'll also get an update on the civil fraud trial of Donald Trump.
No matter how powerful you are, no matter how much money you think you may have, no one is above the law. And it is my responsibility and my duty and my job to enforce it. The law is both powerful and fragile. And today in court, we will prove our case.
We'll also speak to an attorney suing Columbia University and its affiliated hospitals on behalf of some 300 more patients who say they were sexually assaulted by former Columbia University gynecologist Robert Haddon over a span of decades, while Columbia, they say, shielded the sexual predator. And we'll look at the largest strike of healthcare workers in U.S. history.
Yeah, we're out here because we want the world to know that Kaiser's being unfair to us. They're not treating us right. We're working through the pandemic. We're working through hard times. We're understaffed, underpaid. They're not giving us what we need to take care of our patients properly.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's defending his decision to waive 26 federal laws in South Texas in order to speed construction of the U.S.-Mexico border wall. Biden's move to advance a central policy of former President Trump's platform has prompted condemnation from immigrant rights, environmental and indigenous activists. At the White House Thursday, a reporter asked Biden why he reversed his campaign pledge that, quote, there will not be another foot of wall constructed in my administration, he said.
I'll answer one question on the border wall. The border wall, the money was appropriated for the border wall. I tried to get them to reappropriate, to redirect that money. They didn't. They wouldn't. And in the meantime, there's nothing under the law other than they have to use the money for what it was appropriated. I can't stop that.
Do you believe the border wall works?
No.
Democratic Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez slammed Biden's decision, writing, quote, a wall does nothing to deter people who are fleeing poverty and violence from coming to the United States. You do not risk your life or your children's lives going through the Darien Gap or traversing hundreds of miles of desert if you have any other options. Walls only serve to push migrants into more remote areas, increasing their chances of death, AOC said. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, and Attorney General Merrick Garland were in Mexico City Thursday meeting with Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who condemned the border wall.
This authorization for the construction of the wall is a step backwards. It doesn't solve the problem. We have to address the causes.
Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas announced the U.S. will resume deportation flights directly to Venezuela, threatening Venezuelan asylum seekers with harsher consequences if they cross the U.S.-Mexico border. For years, the U.S. government did not regularly deport Venezuelans because of tensions between Washington and Caracas. Thousands continue to flee Venezuela due to an economic catastrophe that's been largely worsened by U.S. sanctions. New York City Mayor Eric Adams is on a four-day Latin American tour to discourage would-be asylum seekers from trying to reach New York. Speaking from Mexico City Thursday, Adams warned the American dream could turn into a nightmare.
We are at capacity, and many people believe when you enter New York City, you're going to automatically have a job. You automatically are going to be living in a hotel, and there's just a climate that's there and just not a reality.
Mayor Adams will also travel to Ecuador and Colombia and visit the treacherous Darien Gap that many migrants are forced to brave on their journey to the U.S.-Mexico border. Adams' trip comes 2 days after he asked a judge to suspend New York City's 42-year-old policy of providing shelter to anyone who seeks it. Immigrant rights groups blasted the move, with the Legal Aid Society warning, quote, street homelessness would balloon to a level unseen in our city since the Great Depression, unquote. Asylum seekers in New York have already been facing barriers getting basic assistance.
I come from Honduras, and I came here because they killed a brother and a nephew of mine. So I was afraid, and I came here. The truth is, I was waiting 24 hours for them to give me some clothes, but ultimately, nothing came of it.
Ukraine says 51 people were killed and 6 others wounded Thursday as a Russian missile struck a store and a cafe in a village in the northeastern Kharkiv region. President Volodymyr Zelensky said the Russian assault was no accident.
The Russian military could not have been unaware of where they were hitting, and it was not a blind strike. People gathered there for a wake, a Christian memorial dinner. Who could launch a missile at them? Who? Only absolute evil. More than 50 people died. Among them was a child, a boy, 6 years old.
Separately, officials said a Russian strike on residential buildings in Kharkiv killed a 10-year-old boy and his grandmother while injuring 26 others. And Russian drones attacked a port in Ukraine's Odessa region early Friday, damaging a grain silo near the Danube River. Syria's health ministry says 89 people were killed and nearly 300 others wounded Thursday as a drone packed with explosives struck a military college graduation ceremony in the city of Homs. It was one of the deadliest strikes against Syrian forces in more than 12 years of civil war. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack, which Syria's government blamed on unspecified terrorist groups. Elsewhere, Kurdish fighters say recent Turkish airstrikes have killed at least 11 people across Kurdish-controlled parts of northeastern Syria, with 5 civilians among the dead. Turkey's intensified cross-border raids since Sunday, when a pair of attackers detonated a bomb outside government buildings in Ankara. Turkey blamed the attack on the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party and the closely affiliated Kurdish YPG militia, which is allied with the U.S. in its fight against ISIS. On Thursday, the Pentagon said one of its F-16 fighter jets shot down an armed Turkish military drone as it approached U.S. forces in Syria and ignored commands to change course. It was an unprecedented direct military exchange between Turkey and the U.S. to NATO allies. In Iran, activists are demanding justice for 16-year-old Armida Yaravand, who remains in a coma after an unexplained incident Sunday aboard a metro train near Tehran. Officials say Yaravand suffered a medical episode causing her to collapse and bump her head on the train door. Her friends and other eyewitnesses say members of the so-called Guardians of Hijab force entered into an altercation with her for not complying with Iran's strict dress code. This comes 1 year after the death of Mahsa Amini while in custody of Iran's morality police, which set off a nationwide uprising. In related news, this year's Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to the imprisoned Iranian human rights activist Narges Mohammadi, deputy head of Defenders of Human Rights Center, for her fight against the oppression of women in Iran. We'll have more on the Nobel Prize after headlines. Here in New York, a prisoner at the notorious Rikers Island jail was declared dead after he was found unresponsive in a cell Thursday morning. Manish Kunwar was just 27 years old. He's at least the 9th person to die in the custody of New York City Department of Corrections this year. In other news from New York, Frank James, who opened fire on a crowded subway train in Brooklyn in April of last year, received 10 life sentences Thursday. Each life sentence corresponds to an injured victim. No passengers were killed in the shooting. The judge said as he delivered the sentence, quote, "Each mass shooting constitutes an act of raw evil," he said. In a victory for voting rights, a federal court has selected a new congressional map in Alabama after the U.S. Supreme Court rejected a Republican gerrymandered map that diluted black votes. The voting age population of the new district is nearly 49% black and could send another Democrat to the U.S. Congress. And actor Julia Ormond is suing Harvey Weinstein for sexual assault. She's also suing Disney, Miramax, and her former talent agency, CAA, for negligence. Ormond, whose lawsuit comes as part of the Adult Survivors Act, says Weinstein forced her to perform oral sex on him when she told her talent agents Brian Lord and Kevin Huvane, she said, about the rape. They told her reporting it would damage her career and that she would not be believed. The CAA went on to drop her as a client. Ormond accuses Miramax and Disney of enabling and covering for Weinstein. Julia Ormond headlined major films in the 90s, but her career waned in the years after the assault and her complaint to her agents. Weinstein is currently serving a 23-year prison sentence in New York for rape. Earlier this year, he was sentenced to 16 years for separate rape and sexual assault charges in California. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show with the Nobel Peace Prize. The chair of the Norwegian Nobel Committee in Oslo announced this year's winner earlier this morning.
Sann Zendegi Azadi. Women, life, freedom. The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2023 to Narges Mohammadi for her fight against the oppression of women in Iran and her fight to promote human rights and freedom for all. Her brave struggle has come with tremendous personal cost. Altogether, the regime has arrested her 13 times, convicted her 5 times, and sentenced her to a total of 31 years in prison and 154 lashes. Ms. Mohammadi is still in prison as I speak. This year's Peace Prize also recognizes the hundreds of thousands of people who in the preceding year have demonstrated against the theocratic regime's policies of discrimination and oppression targeting women.
That was Berit Reiss-Andersen, the head of the Norwegian Nobel Committee in Oslo, announcing that the imprisoned Iranian human rights activist Narges Mohammadi has been awarded this year's Nobel Peace Prize. The announcement comes just a year after the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini, who died in Iranian police custody September 16th last year, after she was arrested by Iran's so-called morality police. Her death sparked months of protests in Iran and a severe crackdown by Iranian authorities. To talk more about this year's Nobel Peace Prize laureate, we're joined by Nigar Mortazavi. She's an Iranian-American journalist, host of the Iran podcast, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. We thank you so much for being with us, Nigar. Can you talk about the significance of this year's Nobel Peace Prize?
Thanks for having me, Amy. Yes, sure. So this doesn't come as a surprise. I think after 1 year of sustained protests by Iranian women and young girls, and so many activists and ordinary citizens really putting their lives on the front line, risking their lives, about 500 protesters losing their lives, protesting for more freedoms and essentially in part of a feminist uprising. And Narges Mohammadi is really one of the most deserved activists when it comes to the fight for rights for women, freedom for all, human rights. She has done a lot of campaigning against the death penalty, execution, and so many other parts of her long-term activism. And also, as it was discussed, at a great personal cost to herself and her family. So I think it's welcome news. This is going to energize, give new, fresh energy to the activists and protest movement inside Iran.
So tell us the story of Narges Mohammadi, how she is now in prison, how she got there.
Well, she's a longtime activist, human rights activist, that has worked with different organizations, as you said, Human Rights Defenders, which also the only Nobel Peace laureate from Iran, Shirin Ebadi, also worked with. And Narges has really continued sort of that line of activism. She has been very vocal against the death penalty, as I said. She's launched many campaigns against essentially changing the laws of execution and trying to abolish the death penalty in the Iranian legal system. She's fought for Iranian women's rights, for political prisoners, for families, and herself has been a political prisoner, arrested many times, jailed to decades of prison in total, and also separated from her family. Her family has been pushed into exile, including her two children, and she's been living separate from them, not being able to travel to see them. They live in exile. They're not able to travel to see her in Iran. And it's just a great personal cause. But she's been a longtime activist and has been detained, pressured, and sentenced for her activism many times, and currently also is serving a prison sentence.
And so she has fought for women's rights. She's also campaigned for the abolition of the death penalty and improvement of prison conditions. When is she expected to be out? And what kind of pressure do you think this puts on the Iranian regime?
Well, this will be essentially a two-edged sword. At this first, it would generate anger from the hardliners in Iran, the Iranian regime, that essentially more and more attention is given to someone that they have been trying to portray as someone who is threatening national security and has been essentially arrested for these security charges as they bring against these activists. But then at the same time, I think it will generate global solidarity, it would generate sympathy, and it would raise the cost for keeping someone so high profile in prison, continuing to detain them, because the attempt is try to silence people and try to sentence and pressure them in the dark without much attention. And this essentially prize will bring even more attention, I would say more power to Nargis and her activism and other activists currently serving prisons in Iran. And hopefully at the end of the day, it will empower her and help her with this kind of global attention and solidarity that it will bring.
This comes 20 years after Shirin Ebadi, the women's rights activist in Iran, was also awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Do you feel there's been progress, Nigar?
Well, I think if we look at it, essentially looking at the long arc of history in a linear line, there has been. The Iranian society has changed a lot. I mean, just looking at the protests of the past year, women and young girls really risking a lot. It comes at a deadly price for many of these protesters and activists. But I also think what we're seeing, for example, the transformation of the Iranian public space when it comes to the issue of hijab, which is also something that Nargis has been opposing, the mandatory hijab laws. We've seen tremendous change and transformation in the Iranian public space. I speak to sources, friends, journalists, activists inside Iran, and there are just so many women and girls right now courageously defying the mandatory hijab, this one discriminatory law against women, essentially gaining their bodily autonomy after the death of Mahsa Amini with the spark of that mass protest. So I think overall, there has been steps backwards, steps forward. But in general, the women's rights and the various rights movement have been pushing forward and making progress in pushing the state back and demanding more rights.
Well, I want to thank you, Nigar Murtazavi, for being with us to talk about this year's Nobel Peace Prize going to Nargis Mohammadi, the Iranian human rights activist who is currently in prison. Nigar is an Iranian-American journalist, host of the Iran podcast, and senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Coming up, we speak to the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston on Donald Trump's civil fraud trial, on why this may mean more to Trump than any others of the trials, as the judge could be leading to the dismembering of Donald Trump's financial empire. Stay with us.
میمونه لالا شب پره
music by the Iranian musician Marjan Farsad. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to Donald Trump's civil fraud trial here in New York, Trump's attorneys are expected to file a motion today to stay the trial pending an appeal of a judge's ruling last week that Trump and his two eldest sons, Eric and Donald Jr., had committed fraud by vastly overstating the assets of their company. The pretrial ruling puts the future of the Trump Organization's real estate empire in jeopardy. Trump voluntarily attended the first 3 days of the trial. During comments to the press, he repeatedly attacked New York's Attorney General Letitia James for bringing the fraud case against him. On Monday, Trump assailed James, who is African-American, as a racist and called the trial judge, Arthur Engoron, a disgrace. On Wednesday, James denounced Trump's comments.
What they were comments that unfortunately fomented violence, and comments that I would describe as race baiting, and comments, unfortunately, that appeals to the bottom of our humanity. I will not be bullied. And so Mr. Trump is no longer here. The Donald Trump show is over. This was nothing more than a political stunt, a fun-raising stop.
On Tuesday, Judge Engoron placed a gag order on Donald Trump, the first on a former president, after he falsely claimed on social media that the judge's law clerk was the girlfriend of Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. The judge barred Trump from posting, sending emails, or making public remarks about members of the judge's staff. To talk more about the opening week of the trial, we're joined by David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter who's reported on Trump for decades. He's the author of three books on Trump, including The Big Cheat, How Donald Trump Fleeced America and Enriched Himself and His Family. Johnston is also a distinguished visiting lecturer at Syracuse University College of Law. David, it's great to have you back with us. If you can start off by talking about the significance of this trial for Donald Trump. I mean, this is a civil trial. He didn't have to show up, though he falsely alleged he was being forced off the campaign trail to show up for this trial.
Well, unlike the four separate criminal indictments where Donald is at risk of incarceration, going to jail, this is a civil trial. But Donald Trump is his money. That's the most important thing to understand about Donald. And of course, his money is always being inflated along with other things. You know, he claims buildings are bigger than they are. He claims more money. And in this case, the judge has already ruled that Donald committed repeated calculated frauds. The issue in this trial, the principal issue in this trial, there's some minor facts, is how much must he disgorge because his frauds resulted in ill-got gains that he must give up.
So talk about why this is so important to me. Another civil trial, right, the sexual assault trial of E. Jean Carroll, he did not show up for.
Well, that's right. And E. Jean Carroll similarly got a judge to rule there was such overwhelming evidence, there was no need to try the merits of the case. Donald Trump is a rapist. That's been established by another judge. He already owes $5 million to the writer E. Jean Carroll. And now there's a second defamation case that she's brought. And there will be a trial only to determine, again, how much money he owes. In this trial, before Judge Engoron, Donald has had all of his business licenses revoked. The Trump Organization, his eyes wide open, blind trust he created when he became president, and the at least 500 Trump legal entities, mostly limited liability companies, no longer have business licenses, and you cannot do business without a business license. The judge has appointed another judge, a retired judge, as a monitor to make sure that Trump and his sons and the two executives who are in the case don't abscond with any of the money until it's determined how much is there. Ultimately, we will see the Trump Organization, his umbrella group, turned over to a receiver. This is similar to bankruptcy when you dissolve a company, but it's under New York State business law. It's not a bankruptcy case. His properties will be sold. Creditors and the government will get paid first. And if there's any money left at the end of the day, Amy, it will go to Donald Trump.
So you're talking about properties. That's Donald Trump's residence in the Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue. That's one of the buildings. Is that right, David K. Johnston? One of the ones that also he, to say the least, inflated from 10,000 feet to 30,000 feet. And why that matters, square feet.
Well, he claimed the building was three times the size it was, so he could justify an enormously higher value than it's worth. And Donald does this all the time. Trump Tower's 58 stories. He'll tell you it's 68 stories. He owns a mansion on a large wooded area in Westchester County, about a short drive from Manhattan. He's claimed it's worth as much as $291 million. The most generous appraisal was $30 million, roughly a tenth of that. And it was based on the idea that he could carve it up into smaller estates and sell them off. And the local authorities have said, no, we're not going to allow you to carve it up. So the property's more likely worth something in the order of, say, $10 million. And Donald's claims are 29 times that much, Amy.
So Samuel Bankman-Fried is on trial right nearby here in New York. He was jailed before the trial for violating a gag order. President Trump has just had a gag order imposed because, among other things, of what he just tweeted out in the midst of the trial, that the clerk who was sitting just feet from him right next to the judge was having an affair with Chuck Schumer. Can you talk about the significance of what it would mean if the judge found him guilty of violating that gag order? Could he end up in the same position as Samuel Bankman-Fried?
He absolutely could end up remanded to jail. Donald is, I believe, for political reasons, trying to provoke one of the judges in his criminal or this civil case to send him to jail so that he can rally his supporters and say, see, the system is rigged. They're out to get me. I didn't do anything wrong, but they're going to shut me up. He threatened General Milley, who just retired as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That's not going to result in being remanded to custody because General Milley, who was a valorous infantryman in combat, is not being intimidated by Donald.
I mean, he essentially said that Milley should be executed.
Absolutely. He said he should be executed. The judge's secretary, however, or clerk, I'm sorry, the judge's clerk, has nothing to do with the merits of the proceedings. And the judge made it clear that you write or say anything about any person on my staff, and there will be consequences. And I think he's made it pretty clear that Trump might get one more chance. But if he does it twice, I assure you, then he's going to be remanded by this judge.
And for people to understand how a decision has been made in parts of this trial, I mean, it is a bench jury. It's a bench trial. It doesn't go to a jury. Oh, and also President Trump lied when he said he had wanted a jury trial because his lawyers never asked for one.
Right. Well, Donald, I'm confident, based on his public remarks, would be very concerned that a New York City jury, a Manhattan jury, could be very bad for him. They might rule very heavily against him. So his lawyers accepted a bench trial, whether they did it by incompetence or intentionally. They agreed to this. So there's no question about that. He's been denied nothing by the judge. And the facts in this case are so overwhelming that Letitia James put before the court, showing that again and again and again, every time the Trumps valued a property, they overvalued it. If there'd been a mixed bag, you know, now and then they overvalued things. Most of the time they were reasonable. That would be different. And, you know, Amy, imagine you own a $300,000 house. Well, maybe it's worth $270,000. Maybe it's worth $330,000. But if you go to a bank and say, loan me money, this house is worth $3 million or $30 million. That's just fraud. So all this trial is about, or primarily what this trial is about, is how much in damages does Donald Trump own for his and his son's years of fraud?
So, David K. Johnston, you have written several books on Donald Trump. Is this case more important to them? He also fell off the, Forbes billionaire list. Than any of the other ones?
Well, it's more important to Donald's mind because he grew up in a household with a father who was just a complete monster who taught him and his other children that all that matters is getting the money. As long as you don't get arrested, do whatever you need to do. There are no rules. You're special. The rules of law, the rules of decency, they don't apply to you. And so to Donald, in his psyche, this is much more important. But the fact is that in the other cases, particularly the effort to overthrow the United States government on January 6th, he faces prison if convicted. But those are down the road a little bit. Right now, he's very concentrated on this. And as I said in the beginning, to Donald, Donald is his money.
David K. Johnson, we thank you so much for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, co-founder of DC Report, author of three books on Trump, including The Big Cheat, how Donald